Right, we're going to continue with Prophets of the Restoration, with the book of Malachi. I want to go over some introductory things before we start looking at chapter 1. If you remember, as we talk about Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, these three prophets are prophets who are prophesying during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. And Ezra and Nehemiah are covering not a huge amount of time, but it's a fair span of time. Haggai and Zechariah are prophesying very much toward the beginning of this time of the restoration. Malachi is prophesying sometime later. How much later? Well, to put this in a little bit of perspective, we know that Malachi, first of all, begins to prophesy sometime after the completion of the Second Temple, which is around 516 BC. It's the sixth year of the reign of Darius. And it's a number of years after both Haggai and Zechariah prophesy. They began to prophesy around 520 BC, if you remember. And I'm going to pinpoint this a little bit more, in large part because of the work of Wieringa, a Dutch Reformed theologian. All right, we know that he began to prophesy at a point in time when the zeal of the people had abated, the purity of the worship was being corrupted, and even when a number of vices had crept in among the people. So there has to be some intervention, time-wise, between Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi. Just, the situation is very different than Malachi is describing. In the book of Malachi, there are warnings which concern the gross sins of both priests and the people. Okay? They're guilty of a number of breaches, and Malachi is going to call them out on that. There's another part of this prophecy which speaks distinctly of the coming of Christ and even of his forerunner, John the Baptist. When exactly prophesied? Well, it's most likely that he prophesied sometime toward the end of Nehemiah's time, which would have been sometime near his second return to Jerusalem. We're going to look at Nehemiah 13:6.
Nehemiah 13, verse 6. But in all this time was not I at Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, came I unto the king, and after certain days obtained I leave of the king.
Okay, so Nehemiah returns sometime later in the reign of Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes actually dies after a reign of 41 years. So this places Malachi's prophesying sometime between 432 and 424 BC. It's nearly, somewhere between 90 and 100 years after these other prophets. Now, that calculation, as I said, is the result of a number of things done by Wieringa, a Dutch Reformed theologian, helping to place a time frame. As I say, we know very clearly it's after the temple has been rebuilt, And also, we need enough time for these people to depart from a certain amount of purity. That they're going to be rebuked. So if Haggai and Zechariah are talking about the things leading up to the millennium, I think what we can see with Malachi is Malachi is going to give us a little bit of a picture of how things are going to get toward the end of the millennium, prior to the second coming, the things that lead up to that. So he's, if we understand that that second temple period is as being, in some sense, typical, then it's pointing in this direction. It's going to give us a little bit of an indication of how things are going to go toward the end of that period of time. Now, there's a second broader category of things that we need to cover, and that is things relating to the prophet himself. And the first thing is, and probably the most definite thing, is that we really don't know a lot about Malachi. But here are a few things that we do know. Malachi's status as a prophet is assumed in the New Testament. If we look at Matthew 11, verse 10, and Mark 9, verse 11. We'll see that there's an assumption. Matthew and Mark, for example, quote Malachi. They assume he's a prophet. And this, by the way, this contention that he's a prophet is not really questioned by the Jews. They see him as the last of their prophets. So this is not surprising. Matthew 11:10 and Mark 9:11.
Matthew 11:10. For this is he of whom it is written, Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare thy way before thee.
Mark 9:11. And they asked him, saying, Why say the scribes that Elias must first come?
Okay, so in both cases, they're referring to Malachi's prophecy, part of which we'll eventually get to, Lord willing. So we're safe in agreeing that he is a prophet of God. His name means my messenger or my angel. It's actually been conjectured that this is not so much a name as an official designation. Probably because of the place that Malachi stands with respect to the rest of the Old Testament, being the last of the messengers. And so in a sense, he is the preeminent messenger. He's the one sort of sealing up the revelation of the Old Testament. Haggai is actually called by this name, if we look at Haggai 1:13.
Haggai 1:13. Then spake Haggai, the Lord's messenger, in the Lord's message unto the people, saying, I am with you, saith the Lord.
he's called the Lord's messenger there. It's the same name, Malachi. Translators of the Septuagint translate by the hand of Malachi, which we'll see in chapter 1, verse 1. They translate it, even though it just says by Malachi, the Hebrew says by the hand of Malachi. The Septuagint translates it by the hand of his angel and messenger. So they didn't consider it a proper name either. Yes.
Really quick, you said that Malachi was the last of the Old Testament prophets. Yes. Was he the one that was pretty much sealing the Old Testament canon? Because wasn't Ezra the one who compiled
Ezra,
the book?
Ezra and Nehemiah are going to be the ones who finally canonize. They're doing that.
I see.
They're overseeing that. Ezra
was just the last inspired
Ezra
prophet.
Ezra oversees most of it. Nehemiah is the end of it.
Okay.
So there's overlap, but it's not. It's not quite done with Ezra. The Targum of Jonathan identifies Malachi as the scribe Ezra. Believe it or not. That is a conjecture which was adopted by Calvin. However, it's very problematic. It's problematic for a couple of reasons. One is the time frame. The other is there is no other Old Testament book which is identified by an official title rather than a personal name. So if this is a case, this is the only case we have like that, I don't think there's any reason to adopt that particular view. There's no compelling reason. There are indications of this, but anonymity of a prophet is not necessarily proof that we're dealing with a title rather than a name, especially when we understand that a lot of Old Testament names have that kind of that structure, that it could be a title. Now Malachi seems to have the same relation to Nehemiah that Haggai and Zechariah had to Joshua and Zerubbabel, or Isaiah to Hezekiah, or even Jeremiah to Josiah. And in fact, there are several themes which are raised in Nehemiah, which also figure into Malachi a bit. For example, mixed marriages, withholding of tithes, and even a certain laxity with regard to Sabbath keeping. These things are common in their own way to both books. So it may very well be that Malachi's message is being reflected to a certain extent in the book of Nehemiah, and Nehemiah's concerns are really those that are being driven by the prophet. The last thing, before we talk about the book of Malachi itself, is Malachi ends his arguments against the Jews precisely where the evangelists take it up. Look at Mark 1, verse 2.
Mark 1, verse 2. As it is written in the prophets, "Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare the way before thee."
So Malachi, there's a certain direction Malachi's arguments are going, and that direction, being at the end of the Old Testament, happens to be picked up at the beginning of the New Testament. The Gospels are all picking it up, and Mark even puts it right at the beginning of his Gospel. Okay, so the period that is, in fact, prophesied, as we'll see toward the end of Malachi, is very clearly the advent of Christ. But if we look at it, if we look at the prophecy, I think we're going to see that there is, and the Jews had a problem with this because of this, there is a looking through, there's a telegraphing effect, where it's very difficult to tell the first from the second advent. So, in a sense, when he's looking through, prophetically, he's seeing not only the first advent, but that's really, in some sense, an anticipation of his coming again the second time. We'll look at that as we get into the book a little bit more. All right. What can we say about the book of Malachi? Well, the first thing is we know that the prophecy consists of six distinct sections. First section is contained in chapter 1, verses 1 to 5, where the prophet is going to lay charges against Israel, mainly by addressing the problem of an insensibility to the love of God and their hardness toward his electing love. So we'll talk about this. We're going to talk about this today, along with part of this next section, the second section, which is contained in chapter 1, verse 6 through 2, verse 9. And here, in this section, he turns his prophetical denunciations toward the priests, and he gets into a series of reproving them for their neglect of the worship of God and their profaning of his ordinances. So he's going to address a number of problems that are arising. And this threatened punishment, this section threatens punishment and actually foretells the calling of the Gentiles. So we'll see a little bit of both as we get into, as we go through chapter 1. All right, the third section is contained in chapter 2, verses 10 to 16, where Malachi is rebuking the Jews over their mixed marriages, and he decries their mistreatment of their Jewish wives in particular. So not only have they corrupted the institution of marriage in some respects, but they've also mistreated their own wives. Right, the fourth section is contained in chapter 2, verse 17 through 3, verse 6. In this section, Malachi predicts the coming of Christ. It talks about his forerunner, John the Baptist. And he also describes here differences between the way Christ would actually appear and the manner that this appearance would be expected by the Jews. Remember, a lot of people, when Christ comes the first time, they don't really get it. They aren't clear as to his first advent. They feel like there should be more to it. Right? This is the result of this looking through this telegraphing effect with regard to prophecy, where they're confounding and confusing the first and the second advents. Now, the fifth section is in chapter 3, verses 7 through 12. And the prophet in this section condemns the Jews for withholding their tithes and the support needed for the maintenance of the true religion among themselves. So that becomes another point of contention. Right, the sixth section, that is chapter 3, verses 13 through 4, verse 6. And that describes the sinful character of the people and actually contrasts that with the character of those who fear the Lord. You know, if you were people that feared the Lord, you would look like this, but this is what you really are. And finally, it describes the contrasting destinies of the ones that are being contemplated there. So that's just a brief outline of the six sections. Right? We're going to begin now to look at Malachi chapter 1 in its entirety. I want to go through the whole thing. There are a couple of interesting twists and turns in it, but there is a coherence to the whole of the prophecy. Remember, it's a relatively short book, and there is some coherence. It holds together, I think, pretty well. So, verse 1.
Malachi 1, verse 1, the burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi.
Okay. By Malachi or by the hand of Malachi, as the Hebrew says. The first thing I think we can notice is this. The prophecy, Malachi's prophecy, is characterized here as a burden, which indicates that it's got a negative connotation. So, I think it's notable and interesting. When the temple was being built, the prophecies were presented in a way that was much more encouraging. Now, Malachi, as we'll see, is prophesying after the temple has been built, and to a people who have now become complacent. So it seems to indicate this. When the church reaches some point of reformation, maybe any point of reformation, there's temptation to grow carnal. There's temptation to sort of sit back and say, well, we're reformed enough. Okay, we've kind of got that all together. For the previous two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, they were bringing encouragement. Malachi now is bringing a very different message, and it's characterized that way. It's a burden. There's another thing, I think, which is notable about this very short verse. If we were to look back at Ezra and Nehemiah, what we're going to find is primarily the people that returned from the Babylonian captivity were from the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. But the inscription here tells us that they, together with any others who returned, are understood to comprise Israel now. So you may have heard stories about and legends about the lost 10 tribes of Israel. But Malachi is indicating to us that these so-called lost 10 tribes had their existence and destiny merged with Judah and Benjamin at the time of the Restoration. So it's a fool's errand to be following after all of these things. The fact is that they may be genetic Jews, but they haven't continued in the religion. All of those who remain are those who are accounted Israel. All right. With that in mind, then, we want to begin looking at some of the faults or charges that are brought against the people of God at this point, beginning at verse 2.
Malachi 1, 2. I have loved you, saith the Lord, yet ye say, wherein hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith the Lord, yet I loved Jacob?
Yeah, was not Esau Jacob's brother, yet I loved Jacob? This verse and the next are pretty familiar to people in Reformed theology. Paul quotes or refers to this in Romans 9, in proof of the election of some to grace. So I think what we can say is this. The first fault that's reproved here is the ingratitude of the people toward God for his electing love. The fact is, they've become by this point insensible to the love of God and their own wickedness. So they don't have a good sense of either. That's why they had attributed the chastisements of the Lord to unjust punishments administered with little or no good reason. Right? I've loved you, saith the Lord, yet you say, wherein hast thou loved us? They missed the point. They failed to see that these chastisements that they've gone through, all these troubles that they faced, were actually the results of the Lord's chastening whom he loves. Now, in order to put a point to this priority of the love of God, he goes on to refer to the fact that Jacob was chosen, even though Esau was the elder brother. Now, the elder brother normally got the double portion, got the blessing, had the responsibility to see that that the family, the whole family, was maintained. The elder brother really assumed that responsibility with respect to the entire family. And so there was usually a priority in Jewish families given to the older brother. But that really doesn't work because we're dealing with, ultimately, remember, we're dealing with that paradigm of Adam and Christ. So the older brother is the one who's rejected, and the younger brother is the one who's accepted. And that's what's happened here. Jacob is chosen. So election unto eternal life is sufficient testimony of the love of God. Should have been enough for them. But God chose Jacob to be the root out of whom the seed of the church is going to be propagated. He did so not because of any foreseen goodness, not because of any merit that was in them, but simply because of his own mere good pleasure. So the prophet's point here is this. The love of God is not dependent upon their obedience or disobedience. Rather, it's the ground of their chastisement and the guarantee that all that befell them was the dispensation of the God who had first loved them. It was meant to bring them around. Okay, if they just had a proper view of all of that. Verse 3.
I hated Esau and laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness.
Okay, I hated Esau. This is really enforcing the point and underscoring the fault of those who didn't get the point. Jacob had been given a fruitful land. And in fact, the descendants of Jacob were now restored again after the captivity. Now, in contrast to this, Esau had been given a hilly and a barren country from which they are now cast out. Israel had complained that it hadn't enjoyed all of the outward prosperity that they expected. Now, they thought that they were guaranteed all kinds of things simply because of their election. They did not consider that there was this dynamic relation that would require an obedience. So they're complaining that they had no tokens of God's love. That's in verse 2, right? Wherein hast thou loved us? But in reply now, it's pointed out, Israel received more favorable treatment than Esau. Now, they might say, oh, Israel's been chastened, they've been afflicted, they've been led into captivity and all these other things. But verse 3 is telling us, Esau was laid waste. So the descendants of Jacob are regathered, but the descendants of Esau are permanently scattered. Now this should have been enough to make them consider, right? But they don't. And so it's enforced even more in verse 4.
Verse 4, whereas Edom saith, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down, and they shall call them. The border of wickedness, and the people against whom the Lord hath indignation forever.
Right, so this verse is reinforcing the point of the previous verse, but it's actually going into some new territory as well. Esau, called in this verse Edom, Edom is Esau, they might think that they're going to recover and return as Judah did, as the descendants of Jacob did. But this verse, just in case they were wondering, this verse is the Lord making clear their condition is irrecoverable. Right? In spite of all of the efforts of man to the contrary, the fact is that when it comes to Esau, the curse of God upon them is stronger than frail man. They're just not going to be able to pull this off. Although Esau was, at the time of the prophecy, somewhat prosperous and even powerful, it wasn't too long after that ruin came to them. And Esau has never returned. There is a place not far from Israel called Petra. You may have seen pictures of it. Ruins. It's a rock city in a valley. That's the ruins of Edom. Nobody lives there anymore. It in fact, for a long time, it was a very difficult place for tourists even to go, because it was a habitation of bandits and different kinds of outlaws in the Middle East. So it was a very dangerous place for a long time to go. And the point here is this. When this judgment falls, it's going to be recalled that sin was the procuring cause. That's why it's called the border of wickedness. And that the reprobation of God ultimately spells the doom of a people. Now, the reason why one people rise and another fall is simply the favor of God. Verse 5.
And your eyes shall see, and ye shall say, the Lord will be magnified from the border of Israel.
Okay, so this verse kind of brings this little discussion to an end, but it's predicting the Lord will eventually convince his people of his love to them. We know from the previous books that is not really going to happen until they're restored shortly prior to the millennium. But here, there is this idea that he's going to eventually convince them. And once the people of God come to understand that what makes one to differ from another is the sovereign electing love of God, the fact is they're going to be better able then to understand the singular kindness that God has actually showed to his church and people. And when that happens, it will in turn elicit from them an acknowledgement and praise. They're going to praise him for it. The reason people don't praise the Lord aright is that they really don't have a correct apprehension of these kinds of things. They don't see it for what it is. They see it only under appearances which are limited by our limited vision. All right, we want to move now to the second fault in verse 6.
Malachi 1, verse 6. A son honoreth his father, and a servant his master. If then I be a father, where is my honor? If I be a master, where is my fear? Saith the Lord of hosts unto you, O priests that despise my name. And ye say, wherein have we despised thy name?
Sorry. So there's a second fault in which the people, especially the priests, are being reproved here. There was, according to Malachi, a contempt for the name of God. And he's saying, if I was a father, if I was a master, father or master would get more respect from his earthly son or servant than God does from those who serve him. So again, this is especially the priests, right, who are being rebuked here. They boasted that God was a father and their ruler. And they expected blessings from his hand. That's the point. But that may be their boast. The reality, the Lord of Hosts points out, is their insincerity. Now, they make their boast of these things, but they're insincere. So without honor, without fear, there really is no reason behind their claim. And in fact, if we understand what is being indicated here, their insincerity is actually a slighting of the name of God. Right, verse 7.
Malachi 1 verse 7. You offered polluted bread upon my altar, and you say, wherein have we polluted thee? You say, the table of the Lord is condemned.
So here, the fault of the people is being prosecuted and proved. And they say, how is it that we've done this? Well, they denied profaning the name of God, but their public service offered, the service they offered in worship, actually proves the point of the prophet. You know, they're, despite all of their vocal objections or denials, the fact is they didn't heed the rule. They offered common bread upon the altar instead of the showbread. And the problem with that, we can see if we look at Leviticus 2, verses 1 through 10. Leviticus 2, verses 1 through 10.
Leviticus 2, verses 1 through 10. And when any will offer a meat offering unto the Lord, his offering shall be of fine flour. And he shall pour oil upon it, and put frankincense thereon. And he shall bring the Aaron's son to the priest. And he shall take thereout his handful of the flour thereof, and of the oil thereof, with all the frankincense thereof. And the priest shall burn the memorial of it upon the altar, to be an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto the Lord. And the remnant of the meat offering shall be Aaron's and his sons. It is a thing most holy of the offerings of the Lord made by fire. And if thou bring an oblation of a meat offering, bacon in the oven, it shall be unleavened cakes of fine flour mingled with oil, or unleavened wafers anointed with oil. And if thy oblation be a meat offering, bacon in a pan, it shall be of fine flour unleavened mingled with oil. Thou shalt parch it in pieces, and pour oil thereon, it is a meat offering. If thy oblation be a meat offering, bacon in the frying pan, it shall be made of fine flour with oil. And thou shalt bring the meat offering that is made of these things unto the Lord, and when it is presented unto the priest, he shall bring it unto the altar. And the priest shall take from the meat offering a memorial thereof, and shall burn it upon the altar. It is an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto the Lord. And that which is left of the meat offering shall be Aaron's and his sons. It is a thing most holy of the offerings of the Lord made by fire.
Okay. So, I want to be clear here. When the prophet calls it polluted bread, it's polluted because they used common bread. They didn't use the bread that he appointed. Common bread would be fine for any other situation. Right? It's not that they offered some kind of bread that was, you know, was spoiled or foul. In this case, they simply didn't offer what he had appointed. And that made it polluted. That was the polluting of the altar. We don't have liberty to offer God things he's not appointed. Doesn't matter how good and useful these things might be in other departments of life. They might be very good. In fact, the common bread may have tasted better than the showbread. The common bread might have excited your sense of smell more than the showbread. I don't know. It doesn't really matter, because the fact that they didn't use the bread that God had appointed and had tried to substitute something else in its place, that polluted the altar. So in this they polluted the Lord. They didn't just pollute the altar. There's a polluting of the Lord who had appointed this service. Because, of course, the showbread is typical of him. You know, this is them trying to substitute something for him. That is, for Christ. And they also made the Lord's table, or his altar, contemptible. And we can see that his table and altar are interchangeable if you look at Ezekiel 41, verse 22.
Ezekiel 41, verse 22. The altar of wood was 3 cubits high, and the length thereof 2 cubits, and the corners thereof, and the length thereof, and the walls thereof were of wood. And he said unto me, this is the table that is before the Lord.
So we can see here what high provocation of God it is to bring his worship and service into contempt, and really how easy it is. All we have to do to bring his worship and service into contempt is to try to offer common bread rather than the showbread. Offer something that he has not commanded rather than what he has appointed. Right? It doesn't have to be something inherently wrong. They're not offering spoiled bread. They're not being accused of that per se. The accusation really falls along the lines of they didn't give him what he wanted. God said, worship me in this way, and they said, we think we have a better way. Now, that's not all. Because as we move from the table of the showbread and the altar, whatever, to the offerings, we find that there's more fault here. Look at verse 8.
Malachi 1, verse 8. And if ye offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And if ye offer the lame and sick, is it not evil? Offer it now unto thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee, or accept thy person, saith the Lord of hosts?
Okay, so the fault is further proved by their offering of the faulty or defective sacrifices, which, by the way, were prohibited by the law. We know this, and we can see this. We look at Leviticus 22, 20 and 21, as well as Deuteronomy 15, verse 21. So Leviticus 22, verses 20 and 21, and Deuteronomy 15, 21.
Leviticus 22, verses 20 and 21. But whatsoever hath a blemish, that shall ye not offer, for it shall not be acceptable for you. And whosoever offereth the sacrifice of peace offerings unto the Lord to accomplish his vow, or a freewill offering in the bees or sheep, it shall be perfect to be accepted. There shall be no blemish therein.
Deuteronomy 15, 21.
Deuteronomy 15, verse 21. And if there be any blemish therein, as if it be lame or blind or have any ill blemish, thou shalt not sacrifice it unto the Lord thy God.
Okay, so the law is very clear, in fact, that things that are being sacrificed, they have to be perfect. They can't have blemishes. So, they only needed to be aware of the law at a very minimal level before they should have been convicted of their consciences that they were breaking the law with regard to this. Now, this should have been a point that everybody in Israel would know. Can't offer something which is sick or lame or blind. Right? So the point here is it's required that all sacrifices bear that outward perfection of Christ, who is the true sacrifice for sin. And it also points to the sincerity which God requires in anything that will be considered an acceptable service. God is not pleased by our lame, sick, and blind services. So it doesn't matter then, if we offer, but we don't offer a right, we're going to fall under this condemnation. Right? There's something wrong with the way they're thinking when they're willing to offer something that is, first of all, condemned in the law of God, and second, that it is an example of their own carelessness in this matter. Now, should they offer this to the governor, who by the way, did receive certain gifts from the people, we see it in Nehemiah. If we look at Nehemiah 5, 14, and 15.
Nehemiah 5, verses 14 and 15. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year even unto the 2 and 30th year of Artaxerxes the king, that is 12 years, I and my brethren have not eaten the bread of the governor, but the former governors that have been before me were changeable unto the people, were tardable unto the people, and had taken of them bread and wine, beside 40 shekels of silver. Yea, even their servants bare rule over them, over the people, but so did not I because of the fear of God.
So, you know, Nehemiah wouldn't have accepted all of this, right? He just simply wouldn't have taken this from them. He wasn't going to accept what was unacceptable to God. And he certainly wasn't going to be pleased with it or accept the persons of those who tried to pass off this lame and blind and sick. Verse 9.
Yeah, so
Malachi's now made the charge. The people are now exhorted to return unto God. But he does this here by way of irony. The fact is, their intercession and the intercession of the priests had been rejected because it was accompanied with this corrupted service. And the point is here in this verse, how could they ever be heard when their service was so faulty? And yet they thought to be heard, even though they had been quite insincere in their worship and service which they offered. This has been by your means. Will he regard your persons? There's an irony to that. It's sort of it's a rhetorical question. The answer is no. You know, your governor wasn't going to be pleased with it. Why should God be pleased with it? He's not going to accept of that.
If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me, right?
Right. And if I'm offering what I know is not perfect, the Lord is not going to hear me either. Now, if you want to drive hymn singers crazy sometime, get them to admit that their hymns are not perfect, and then ask them why they think they can get away with something that God didn't permit even for the children of Israel when he bore with this kind of nonsense from time to time. Alright? But this is what they thought they were going to do. Verse 10.
Verse 10. Who is there even among you that would shut the doors for naught? Neither do you kindle fire on my altar for naught. I have no pleasure in you, saith the Lord of hosts. Neither will I accept an offering at your hand.
Who is there even among you that would shut the doors for naught? Don't even kindle fire on mine altar for naught. So now, he's going after the mercenary spirit a bit. He's holding it up for reproof. He brings up the porters, the people who hold the doors, and the priests in the temple, and points out they would do nothing without some reward. They're unwilling to do the smallest thing, or that they would profit them the most spiritual. They don't even care if it would profit them spiritually. They don't want to do it without some kind of payment. So, consequently, they exhibit no zeal for the purity of God's house. So, without this, without sincerity and zeal for the true religion, neither their persons nor their worship is going to be accepted. You should probably keep in mind it's better to avoid insulting the majesty of God than trying to offer service which he's not commanded. God views it as an insult. It's not some minor thing. He's insulted by it. And it's contrary to what he's commanded. We want to look down at verse 11.
For from the rising of the sun even unto the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles, and in every place incense shall be offered unto my name, a pure offering, for my name shall be great among the heathen, saith the Lord of hosts.
Yeah, so it's from this lack of sincerity, lack of concern to the purity of the worship of God, that Malachi is now saying God is going to transfer the priesthood from the Jews and establish it among the Gentiles, the nations. Because there are people in a ministry that are going to magnify his grace. That's what he's saying. So if one of the Jews is going to vindicate the name of God in his own temple, then he's going to have... I should say, if none of the Jews are going to vindicate the name of God in his own temple, he's going to have his name glorified by calling the Gentiles into his church. He's not going to allow his name to be dragged through the dirt. Okay. He's not going to allow his profanation. And again, what is profaning the name of God? Corrupted worship. The way the people of God are corrupting the name of God is they're corrupting his worship. They're offering him common things instead of the things he's appointed, and even corrupt things in that he's prohibited. They don't care. This is a profaning of the name of God. And for this, God tells the Jews he's taking the true religion away from them. He's going to give it to the Gentiles. So this verse is pointing then to the advent of Christ and the commission to take the gospel into all nations. Right, we're going to look at verse 12.
Malachi 1, verse 12. But ye have profaned it, in that ye say, the table of the Lord is polluted, and the fruit thereof, even his meat, is contemptible.
Yeah. So the equity or the fairness, the justness of this decision to reject the Jews and choose the Gentiles in their place, now he's going to enforce that in this verse and what follows. Right. The fruit of the altar, that refers to the offerings of the people from which the priests obtain their subsistence serving the altar. If you remember, when the priests served the altar, they got to keep and eat a certain amount of the meat. They only had a couple of days to eat it. The third day they had to burn it. But they were given meat from the altar. They were being sustained by this. But the indication here is the priests actually desired more than the food of the altar. So they're not content with their station in life, and this discontent demonstrates their hypocritical and formal worship by which they profane the name of God.
Kind of like the papists would do, like these priests asking for extra money and all this kind of stuff.
It's not far from that. They're looking for more. Remember Eli's sons. who fall into this this sort of mentality where they begin really to steal stuff that is coming into the temple, stuff that didn't belong to them, in order to enrich themselves. They're greedy, and they're really intent to have this luxurious lifestyle.
Would this fall under simony?
not really simony in the sense that they're buying and selling church office, but there's certainly a greed factor going on here. Okay, so the words and actions that they have actually show that they have a fair contempt for the true service of God. So despite all of their protestations to the contrary, whenever it comes right down to it, they demonstrate themselves to be discontents. They're hypocritical. They're formalists. Verse 13.
Malachi 1, verse 13. He said also, "Behold, what a weariness it is, and ye have snuffed at it, saith the Lord of hosts. Ye brought that which was torn, and the lame, and the sick. Thus ye brought an offering. Should I accept this of your hand, saith the Lord?"
Yeah, so the point is they're asking how they profaned. God is telling them, this is how you profaned. And then he goes on to note, the prophet goes on to note that these priests are actually saying that serving as a priest has become wearisome to them. And that's demonstrated, right? They're turning down their faces at the provision of the altar. They kind of, there's a certain amount of snobbery. There's a reason for this. If we look at what the prophet is saying, there is this idea here in this chapter that those who are carnal, those who are not spiritual in their dispositions, they're in time, they're going to find the service of God wearisome. They're going to repine at performing all of the services that are required. The thoughts are going to be very much like is said in another one of the prophets. When will the Sabbath be over so that I can go and buy and sell? That's the mentality that starts to set in. There's a carnal mindset. And so, although they've grown weary, the fact is, from what we can see here, people who grow weary of religion, they don't always abandon religion altogether. It would be better in one respect that they did, so they didn't muddy the waters. But instead, what they do is they find excuse to offer sacrifices that are corrupt. The people who corrupt worship, people who are content with corrupt worship, they're already declaring that they find the true religion wearisome. You read some of the arguments against the psalmody or in favor of instrumental music or why we need to celebrate holy days. These are people who find not only the worship of God, but maybe even life itself intolerable without corrupting the worship of God. It'd be better if they just went off, left religion alone altogether, and just declared themselves, I don't know, whatever they are, agnostics, atheists, pagans. But they don't very often do that. They don't very often go out that with that kind of fanfare, right? Usually, what people do is they'll move from a strict observance of religion to something a lot less strict. They have no problem watering down, diluting, or corrupting the worship of God. They don't care for seeking that perfect sacrifice commanded by God. They're content rather with what is easy and what is at hand. This is part of their being carnal. And so disregard for the regulative principle of worship is simply this. According to this chapter in Malachi, it's ill-disguised contempt for the Lord. consequently, he's not going to accept it. You can try to dress it up however you want, but I don't care how much lipstick you put on that pig, God still isn't kissing it. He's not accepting it. It's just not going to be acceptable for him. You can try to dress it up all you want. You can hang all your fine pretexts and premises out. You can do all your special pleading. But God does not accept this. And he views this as a contempt for himself. You're polluting his name. And in polluting his name, you're doing everything in your power to pollute God. So verse 14.
Verse 14. For cursed be the deceiver, which hath in his flock a male, and voweth, and sacrifices unto the Lord a corrupt thing. For I am a great king, saith the Lord of hosts, and my name is dreadful among the heathen.
Yeah, here is a curse pronounced upon those who think that they can stay upon their own hypocrisy. They think that they can maintain it, that they can get away with it. It's going to be okay. They offer what's left over to God rather than the first fruits. So in this verse, both the people as well as the priests are being reproved for offering the corrupt and uncommanded, especially under pretext of zeal and piety. Now the reason for the curse is this. Ultimately, every violation of the regulative principle under the Old and under the New Testament represents a disregard and contempt for Christ the mediator. It represents a claim on the part of those who do so that they can do whatever they want, including evil, that good may come. It represents the principle that grace, in fact, the grace abolishes the law. But as is pointed out in this verse, the very heathen are often more fearful of offending God than his chosen people. Why should we offer God what he has commanded? For I'm a great king, said the Lord of hosts. That's Christ speaking. He's a mediator. He is the one speaking to his people out of the cloud, out of the fire. He said, there's a curse on you if you don't sacrifice that which I've commanded. Right, next time we're going to look at Malachi 2 and we'll continue with some of the complaints that God has against his people after the temple's been rebuilt. And we'll see that complacency continues unabated.
Which goes to show, like in that one sermon you preached a couple, 2 years ago, whatever, you know, false worship destroys nations.
Yes, false worship destroys nations. It destroyed Israel. Their false worship is at least in part implicated for why the true religion is going to be taken from them and given to the Gentiles. Because they haven't worshipped God in the way that he's commanded. They profaned his name. So next time, Malachi 2.